Yeah, thanks. Yeah, so let me thank Andrew for getting me here. So I want to talk a little bit about our recent work on the electron hole symmetry in the iron arsenic based superconductors. And this work is mostly done by the students and postdocs, including Chenlin Zhang, Miaoying Wang, Jun Zhao, and Leland Herrick, and Oliver Lipscomb at UT, and also a student at the IOP, Ming Wang, and Hui Chen Luo, and Shi Liang. And then the experiments were done actually at several different facilities at NIST at Oak Ridge in collaboration with Jeff Lin and my former student Song Xueqi, and then at the Oak Ridge with Carlo Marti, Mark Lumpston, and Doug Abernathy, and Andy Christensen, and Takashi Igami. And then the samples actually, because of my Chinese connection, a lot of them are from IOP, Nanling Wang's group. And then we recently, on the potassium sample, we actually grew ourselves at UT. So that's, and theoretically, we've been talking to Jiang Hu at Purdue IOP and then Xiang Tao at the IOP. So now let me sort of give, since this is an expert audience, let me give a very brief introduction to what we are here, you know, try to solve. So we know and love, you know, in the case of a high temperature copper oxide superconductors, we know the parent compound is a long-range ordered anti-ferromagnet, and it's an insulator. It's known to be a mod insulator. And we've been studying, you know, at least as far as neutron scattering is concerned, for more than 20 years, that, you know, what is the evolution of a static anti-ferromagnet evolving into a superconductor. So the discovery of iron arsenic-based superconductors 2.5 years ago, you know, ignited another interest, because of this class of material, the parent compound, is also a long-range ordered anti-ferromagnet. And you can see that the phase diagram, you know, comparing the cuprates, which is on the left, and the pnictite, which is on the right, it's you know, very much similar. And the question, you know, one wants to ask is what is the similarities and differences between the cuprates and that of the copper oxide, and whether one can, you know, unify them under a single, you know, mechanism for superconductivity. So essentially, as far as neutron scattering is concerned, you know, what we wanted to do is actually a very, very simple. The thing we wanted to do is to see first, understand, you know, what is the nature of magnetism in the parent compound. And in the case of copper oxide, you know, we know it very, very well. It's an insulator, and it's a mod insulator. We can understand the spin excitations, you know, via simple Heisenberg exchange coupling with essentially only the nearest neighbor exchange. And the spin are completely localized. And the thing that's different about pnictite is that the parent compound is anti-ferromagnetic, but it's metallic or semi-metals. So the question really is, you know, what is the microscopic origin of the magnetism? Well, the itinerancy also play an important role in the magnetism of iron pnictite. So that's the first question, you know, we wanted to address, you know, via neutron scattering. And the other question we wanted to address is that once we understand, you know, the parent compound and its exchange couplings, you know, we wanted to understand, you know, what happens when you're doping electrons or holes into it, thus, you know, making it into a superconductor. And we want to compare and contrast that, you know, with that of the copper oxide, you know, a superconductor. So these are essentially, you know, the two goals we wanted to, you know, address. Also, of course, you know, once we understand the spin excitations, you know, in the superconductor, we would want to understand, you know, what is the relationship between superconductivity and spin excitations. And whether, you know, the spin excitations can tell us anything, you know, about the gap symmetry of the system. So if I look at the families of, you know, iron arsenic or iron, you know, selenium, you know, based superconductors, there are essentially four classes of material that's been discussed. And the originally discovery, of course, was made by Osono's group, and it was discovered on the lanthanum iron arsenic oxygen. And this is what's called the 1111 family of materials. But unfortunately, you know, there hasn't been as many studies on this class of material, because the single crystals of this class of material are very hard to come by, at least, you know, as far as a neutron scattering is concerned. And the other class of material that's been heavily studied, in fact, I'm going to be mostly talking about this, is a so-called, you know, 122 families of materials. And this class of materials are essentially has a, you know, sort of a two layers within the unit cell, but has the same magnetic structure, and you can dope electrons or holes into this class material, and have very high quality single crystal can be obtained. And therefore, you know, it's much easier to study the spin excitations as well as other electronic properties of these material. And third class of material is so-called the single layer 111 class of materials, And there's also hasn't been as much a study in this class material, and also due to the difficulty of growing single crystals. And finally, there has been quite a bit of work on the 1-1 family and of materials where the superconductivity can arise by replacing tellurium with selenium. And more recently, superconductivity can also be arising from iron selenide by intercalating with potassium, essentially replacing arsenic with selenium, and then you put more potassium, replacing barium with potassium. It's also a superconductor with a TC of about 33 Kelvin. So let me address the first question of what neutron scattering can do. And the question we wanted to understand is that before we talk about a superconductor and how the spin excitations change as a function of a TC for superconductor, we better understand what is the nature of magnetism in the parent compound. I mean, that's the first thing we want to understand. And initially, our group as well as other various other groups have done the diffraction experiment and have completely solved the magnetic structure of the system via neutron scattering. So I'll not talk about the details of that because that's 2 years old work. So essentially, the outcome of the neutron scattering experiment essentially revealed two things. The first thing it revealed is that the magnetic structure for the so-called 1-2-2 and for the 1-1, in fact, for all the iron arsenic based materials, have essentially this kind of a magnetic structure. So when the system goes from a paramagnetic to anti-ferromagnetic state, in addition of the system becoming anti-ferromagnetic, and there's also a simultaneous structural distortion. And this structural distortion, in the case of 1-2-2, occurs at exactly the same temperature when the system becomes anti-ferromagnetic. And the structural distortion essentially is changing the system from tetragonal to orthorhombic, where the orthorhombic longer axis is along the direction of the spins. So this would what we call the AX direction of the anti-ferromagnetism. Along the B-axis direction, the spins are parallel to each other. So this is what typically people initially call stripe-like, or later people more appropriately call the collinear anti-ferromagnetic structure. And this structure is ubiquitous for all the iron arsenic-based parent compound. So one thing that's really strange in the case of 1-1 class of material is that in the case of iron telluride, the spin structure is actually different from that of the 1-1-1-1 and 1-2-2 class materials. And in this case, your spin structure actually is sort of a rotated 45 degrees from that of the 1-2-2, and it's actually forming this class of a structure. This structure was actually not solved recently. This actually was first noticed back in the 70s. And in fact, there's a neutron scattering paper published on this. It was in the 70-something, but unfortunately, it was written in French. So very few people actually knew about this. We realized this after we'd done our neutron scattering experiment. We realized that this structure was actually not new, but solved like many years ago. But, yeah. No, it's also, there's also, this is what people call bicollinear structure. Yeah. So the question we wanted to understand from inelastic neutron scattering point of view is to see what is the exchange coupling that can give rise to such magnetic structures, and also this exchange coupling, whether that can be understood from a localized type of picture or has to be understood from itinerant point of view. So this is the first question I wanted to address before I talk about the doping it with either electrons or holes. This was actually, like I said, first discovered in the 70s. This is the ground state spin structure, yes. And there's no excitation measurement on it. Yeah, so I will present the first inelastic neutron scattering experiment completely determine the spin wave. And
is it true that there are no spin waves on top of this thing?
This class material? There are spin waves. I'll show the data.
On top of this thing?
Yeah. I mean, so you always have spin waves. Once you have static long range order, you always have spin waves. Yes. Yeah.
But the next plane is the same?
Yes. It's there's no coupling along the C axis. Yes. Well, actually, yeah, it's very weak coupling along the C axis. So let me before I talk about what is the understanding of the current understanding of the iron pentatide, it's interesting to review what do we know about the copper oxide superconductors. And in the case of copper oxide superconductors, for example, the prototypical material, lanthanum-2, copper-04, that we understand very, very well. It's a localized system. And if you do simple spin wave measurement, you're essentially going to see spin wave cones as you gradually go out to larger energies. And by fitting the spin wave cones, you can determine the exchange coupling of the system, via a simple Heisenberg type of model. In fact, this was not done until 2001. And remember, the discovery was made in 1986. And this was because the neutron scattering techniques, has not allowed, measurement of spin waves up to 200, 300 milli-electron-volt until the discovery or development of the spallation neutron source. And that's essentially the only way you can measure to such high energies. But once it's said and done, one can see the dominant exchange coupling are the nearest neighbor exchange coupling, which is on the order of 100, 20 milli-electron-volt, and which essentially sets the energy scale for the parent compound. And there's very little spin wave broadening in the case of a copper 2 or lanthanum 2 copper 04. So meaning the system can be entirely described by essentially the nearest neighbor exchange coupling, which is about 90% of the weight. There's a little bit quadratic term, but that's a cyclic term that's very small. So the question in the case of pentatide, as soon as the pentatide was discovered, there's actually first theoretical calculation suggesting there has to be spin density wave order in such a system, based simply on the argument through the band structure calculation, where one sees a pocket around gamma point, hole pocket, and an electron pocket around end point. And people have argued that because of this electron hole pocket, there must be nesting between the quasi-particle excitations between these two states. And in fact, the magnetic structure, I should say, the correct magnetic structure was actually first predicted by theory before the neutron scattering experiment. So this gave a very interesting question, whether the spin waves in such a class of material is really localized or itinerant in the parent compound. So we've done a neutron scattering experiment on essentially two materials of the parent compound. And the first one we've studied is the calcium iron 2 arsenic 2, where we looked at the spin waves in the parent compound. And if you think about the magnetic exchange coupling in the parent compound, Let me sort of go back a little bit to the slide that shown the parent compound. You see, you have the exchange coupling along the A direction. This is the orthorhombic longer axis direction, and that is anti-ferromagnetic. And then you have the exchange coupling along the B direction. That's essentially ferromagnetic. But in order to form such a structure, your direction along the A axis, not necessarily has to be different from the B axis. In fact, theoretically, it was argued that the reason one forms this magnetic structure is because of frustration, in which your exchange coupling along the A axis has to be equal to the exchange coupling along the B axis. Then you have a finite exchange coupling around J2, which form a frustrated system in which you form this kind of a magnetic structure. Alternatively, you could have a system where there's no frustration, meaning that you would have anti-ferromagnetic exchange along A axis and then ferromagnetic exchange along B axis. But this was thought to be very hard to understand because the lattice constant and everything else is so close between the A and B axis. So this was a problem that was not solved when the structure was magnetic structure was determined. So we set out to do this last year. So we essentially map out the spin waves from essentially the zone center all the way to zone boundary. And one thing you see from this data immediately is that spin wave essentially form simply cones gradually going out. But as it forms a larger and larger cones until it reaches the zone boundary, you see something quite clear. What you see is that you don't really have a circle. You essentially have an ellipse that's transversely more extended along the y-axis direction. And the other thing you see is that the spin wave excitations are much broader near the zone boundary. They're certainly not instrument resolution limited. And from that perspective already, there has to be something contributing to it from itinerant point of view. Because in the case of copper oxide superconductors, where you have strictly local moment, everything is resolution limited all the way to the zone boundary. And you can see it's really become broad near the zone boundary. The A axis will be along along the 1-0 direction, and the b-axis would be along the all the samples are twinned. I'll come back and explain, you know, because the most important question people always ask me is how come you have a twin sample, you can still resolve the difference between J1A and J1B. I'll explain that in a slide. The zone boundary is plotted as the dashed line. So now let me try to show you the spin wave data in such a system. So along the a-axis, you have to take my words, you know, for that these measurements are you know considered the essentially a sort of detuned case. I'll explain this, like I said. So you can do spin wave a measurement and then try to use a simple Heisenberg exchange coupling model to try to model the spin wave excitations. So the way you do this is by measuring the dispersion of the spin waves along you know high symmetry directions, for example along the h direction and along the k direction. And then you know what you can do is to try to see using a simple Heisenberg model with the various exchange couplings, you know, what you'd expect to be observing in terms of dispersion curves. So if you assume J1A equals J1B, you'll expect to see a very large softening along the k direction, and this is sort of expected spin wave excitation. You see, for excitations below 100 millivolt, you can hardly tell the difference between J1A and J1B equal or not equal model. So the difference really arises from the k direction, you know, where you expect to see a very large softening when J1A does not equal to J1B. When they're equal, you expect to see a very large softening. When they do not become equal, you don't expect much of a softening. So you can see the data clearly suggest there's no softening along the k direction, thus indicating that your J1A is very much anti-ferromagnetic, and your J1B is actually ferromagnetic. And you have a very large electronic anisotropy between A and B direction. Yes, Andre. Okay.
Is it convenient question? It's really a question. Is it a convenient language to describe what happens, or do you think that localized picture generally is more appropriate than indigenous picture?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So from neutron scattering point of view, I mean, the only way we know how to fit a spin wave is essentially to use what we call the effective Heisenberg model. So whatever the ultimate exchange coupling that's responsible, you know, for making the spin structure, what we determine from neutron scattering point of view is an effective exchange coupling. It's just like when you fit spin wave and when you fit phonon dispersion curves, you can use effective exchange coupling of the nearest neighbor, next nearest neighbor, whether it's a metal or insulator, you know, it doesn't matter. You can fit the phonon dispersion curve as long as you can introduce more and more exchange couplings. When it becomes itinerant, then more and more exchange coupling will contribute to the phonon dispersion curve. So in the case of spin wave excitations, you know, the way we fit it is you know, assuming that we have nearest neighbor and next nearest neighbor, and so far it appears that's all we will need to solve this problem. So the exchange coupling we get is what we call effective exchange coupling, regardless whether it arises from localized or itinerant type of picture. Except for the width. Yeah, the width you would not get. You know, you can introduce that from Heisenberg model as well, assuming some sort of damping. In fact, in the case of a pnictite, I mean, the you can still account for, you know, you can still account for the assuming it's not resolution limited, but you can assuming account for it. It can still account for the data assuming some sort of a width broadening. So this was sort of what I call old result. That was last year's result. Yeah. We try, that doesn't help. So it's not necessary. Yes. So now let me show you some new data that's yet to be published. So previously we've studied the calcium 122, which has a nil temperature of 200 Kelvin. So but most of the work that's on doped material is actually done on the barium iron to arsenic tube. So we thought, you know, let's try that and see whether, you know, what is the difference between this one and the one in terms of calcium 122. So immediately we find some differences. I was quite shocked initially, you know, we found. Let me show you a first thing that we sort of steal from Ian Fisher actually my graduate student emailed Ian Fisher asking for the data, that this is the resistivity data that's been obtained by Ian Fisher's group, that where he measured the resistivity along the A and B axis and used a detuned sample and discovered you have a very large anisotropy between A and B axis, electronic resistivity. So then we wanted to see what happened to spin waves in this class material. So we did essentially exactly the same measurement as we did in calcium case, except now we used the sample mass of 5 times more. So the quality of data in the new measurement are much better than the quality of data in the old measurement. So let me sort of show you the raw data first. You can compare with calcium 122, and then I'll show you the dispersion, and then discuss my explanation of the data. So you can see the data quality here are actually much better than the data quality that we obtained last year in the case of a calcium 122. So at low energies, you see exactly the same thing as you see in the calcium 122. For example, this is spectra at 26 millielectron volt. See, in the calcium data, we have to do four-fold symmetry because we have 5 grams of sample. So now we have 30 grams of sample put in the beam. You can see that we don't have to do four-fold symmetry at all. You can measure all the zones throughout the entire Brillouin zone. So low energy, you see this vertical transverse-shaped excitation. As you gradually go out, initially it becomes circular-like, exactly as what we see in the case of calcium-doped case. But by the time you get to 80 to 100 millielectron volt, you see something dramatically different. You no longer see this ring gradually become larger and larger. In fact, what you observe is that the breakdown of the spin excitations, you can see the spin excitation break into two parts. Essentially, it's this vertical ellipse that break into a part, one on top, one on bottom. And we were very, very puzzled initially to try to understand this data. And finally, when we realized your electronic resistivity is dramatically different between A and B direction, and we realized that the electronic damping, of the spin wave damping of the system, must have been different between the A and B direction as well. So you can see then gradually you go to the zone boundary, finally emerges around this kind of a dispersion. So we look at the dispersion of the system along the K direction, which is the direction vertical, to this axis. And this, again, is the anti-ferromagnetic wave vector. Along the vertical direction, you can go all the way to the zone boundary. Again, showing up here, it's about the 200 millivolts, very similar to the case of calcium 122. Again, you can see if I assume J1A equals to J1B, I would expect to see a much softer spin wave excitations. I don't. So this is consistent with the case of a calcium 122. But on the H direction, you can see my spin wave are essentially non-observable right after 70, 80 millielectron volt. So my dispersion are essentially completely damped out, about 90, 80 millielectron volt. So this would suggest you have a very anisotropic damping in spin waves along the A axis and along the B axis. The A axis damping is more, indicating it's more metallic. And this is consistent, with the transport measurement suggesting A axis is more metallic than the B axis. And A axis, remember, is the anti-ferromagnetic direction. Yeah?
If I look at the curve on the left.
Yes. Oh, actually, this error bar is a bit of a misleading because this error bar is because the high energy spin excitations is very, very hard, to measure precisely where the energy occurs using either the energy cut or Q cut. So this error bar is in fact, the range of the energies that we can possibly see excited. You can see at the zone close to the zone boundary, it become much more mesh-like. So depending on whether you use a Q cut or energy cut, so that's the maximum possible deviation. That's not really the width of the excitations that we see. Yeah, in both cases they're very, very similar. So in a way, what I'm telling you now is that from our data, it becomes immediately clear that barium considering is more metallic than the calcium case. Certainly it's much more anisotropic. In terms of AB directions. Yeah.
In terms of the low energy power spectrum, high energy power spectrum separately by some sort of damping to energy
range. Then you get a different exchange coupling.
Just a point here, is the damping
Oh yeah, it's quite different. Yeah, the high energy part is the damping is different from the low energy part. Essentially, is the same between calcium and barium. Yeah, it's very similar. So now let me sort of this is sort of our fit assuming anisotropic damping. We can essentially describe the whole spectra. So with exchange coupling, fairly similar to the case of barium case, you know, calcium case, 50, 60, and then B is a minus 9, and then J2 is about 13. Yeah, here's the slide. So the question I always get asked is that, you know, how come, you know, you can separate A and B direction when you have a twin sample? So this actually is really a very nice a feature of a neutron scattering on this particular magnetic structure. Because, you know, the magnetic structure in the orthorhombic sample only occurs along the 100 direction, along the A-axis direction. So effectively, you know, your 100 would have a Bragg peak. Your 010 would not have a Bragg peak. So your spin wave are stemming from the Bragg peak intensity. So if you have a D-twin sample, and if you have a D-twin sample, you would expect to see spin waves only along this direction, but not in the direction, you know, perpendicular to it. So you'd expect to see, you know, simple spin wave excitations with the cones gradually become larger along the anti-ferromagnetic order because there's no spin waves along the other direction. So in a twin sample, what you do is that you have 50% of the scattering, you know, arises from here, and then you just rotate this pattern by 90 degrees, and you'll arrive at another spectra from there. And then what you observe is addition of both excitations. Yes, Andre.
But going back to the figure on the right, why is there no speed
wave
in the other direction? I mean, I would understand gap.
But the gap is very, very large. The gap is about 80, 90 millielectron volt.
Right.
Sorry?
We're talking about the range
between
100 and 200.
Yeah, but only when you have spin wave intensity is also dramatically different. Only when you go beyond the gap, then you'll see both merges together. Yeah, so that's how you can separate. That's how you can essentially separate these. And by adding these two together, then this is sort of the excitation you'd expect. And this is in the computer calculation, when we simulate the data, we actually consider equal twinning between A and B direction and add the intensity together and then use that as a way of fitting the observed magnetic spectra. Yes. Oh, I don't have a, I we have a figure in the paper, but I haven't put it. We just assume the anisotropic damping as a function of angle. I mean, that's sort of the way we choose that is kind of arbitrary. But we assume that, you know, it's a parameter, right? We threw in that, and then we were able to completely fit it. Oh, I forgot already, but it's in our preprint. It's on the web, yeah. But we have a picture of that, yeah. It's a phenomenological input, yes. Because there's no theory telling us, you know, what should be the really the differences between the two. Yes. Yes.
Can I come back to something you mentioned at the beginning? Let's say I take the phonon and I go to the very simple equivalent matter like the luminum. And then I can fit the using here, the Newton's methane data. In fact, I know that with just years neighbor. So the phonon force country model is very local. We computed the distance indication of how the ion-ion interaction is created and this and that, and it's very local. So for the quantum spectrum of the phenomenon, as I said, it's going to be nearest neighbors.
Right, right.
This doesn't tell me, from my understanding, anything about the localization properties of the electron.
I completely agree. I mean, but the point I'm trying to make is that.
Right. So it's the same if you fit the phonon
in
the
Yeah, so the fact that you see strong damping means that there must be electron-electron interactions, because strictly localized spins would not give that. And your spin wave should be completely resolution limited throughout. So the fact that we see this strong anisotropy will suggest to us that you must have electronic anisotropy between A and B direction. So in the electronic itinerancy between A and B direction. So that's the first statement I can safely make. And the second statement I can safely make is that these sort of models that, I mean, the Heisenberg model by its nature is sort of a phenomenological model, but it's from a localized point of view. So what I'm saying is that, based on this, I can get an effective exchange coupling by only considering, the nearest and the second nearest neighbor. I can fit it as to whether that really indicating the system is a localized picture or not. I mean, I would not, want to argue one way or the other. But I can tell you that that can give you a correct effective exchange coupling constant. Yes, Jimmy.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that what you do see is relatively well-defined.
Yes. Yes.
And no boundary at higher.
Yes, yes.
So relatively short, some time scale, some land scale, they look like.
Yeah.
I'm not sure about it. I mean, if you go to 100 MeVs, then if you look at non-color cooling, but if you look at spectral scans, I think it's still the
problem. But can I continue? Because otherwise, there's no way I can finish. Yeah, R you see very well defined spin wave as well. In fact, people have seen, I mean, the latest data on time of flight machine done by Toby Perrin, they see up to 400 milli electron volt. And they don't see any sign of, they don't, as far as I know from what he told me verbally, I will not, I haven't seen the data, but from what he told me verbally that they see very well defined spin wave. And they don't see really the Stoner continuum per se, even in the case of R, yeah. So not only will tell you sort of the sort of a striking new result that we sort of obtained, and in a typical prototypical spin waves, you would expect when the system goes into paramagnetic state, your spin wave will become damped out, right? Become paramagnetic. You shouldn't see localized excitation at all. So everything should be centered around zero energy and Lorentzian-like damping. So what we discovered in the case of iron arsenic superconductors is that when you look at excitations are fairly low energy, say for example 50 milli electron volt, you see the broadening of spin waves and weaker of the spin waves as you gradually go out to above Tn. Tn is by the way 140 Kelvin. So at intermediate energy you also see similar things, but when you go fairly close to the zone boundary, for example about 150 milli electron volt, you can see the spin wave excitations has essentially no temperature dependence whatsoever. And this clearly indicates that if you plot the dispersion curve of the system, at low energies, 150 K, at low energies, these excitations are broadened out. But around the zone boundary, your spin excitations does not know whether you're in the order state or it's actually in the paramagnetic state. Remember what I said earlier, that when you go from paramagnetic to orthorhombic state, you also have this phase transition from tetragonal to orthorhombic. And this orthorhombicity was thought to be the reason, why you have such a large difference between J1A and J1B. And what this data essentially immediately tells you is that in this case, there's no lattice constant difference between J1A and J1B, yet you still don't see any softening of the spin wave excitations, or what I call spin excitations near the zone boundary. So, sorry? About 220 milli electron volt. Oh, you mean that's? I have a figure. So now let me to really show you this is we're really talking about spin excitation, because there's an old debate between Gan Shirani and Hermuk. When you do constant Q scans and constant energy scans in nickel and iron, the debate about lasted 10 years. What is the correct way of doing it? And everybody agreed the correct way of doing it is to do energy cuts. So let me show you the data. At low energies, at low temperature, you have a very well-defined spin wave in the energy cut. But when you go to the paramagnetic state, and this very well-defined peak disappears, centered around zero energy, that's exactly what you expect, in the paramagnetic state. But now, when you change the system into the zone boundary, say, for example, at about 80 milli electron volt, you still see some changes from, 7K to 125K to 150K. But by the time you reach into 120 milli electron volt, the excitations has no temperature dependence between 7K and 150K. So that we're indicating this is really very well-defined excitation. And you can't tell the difference whether it's in the low temperature spin wave state or in the high temperature paramagnetic spin excitation state. And there's no difference not only in width, but also in energy. So if you do a wave vector cut, and that's what typically people do, and you can see at low energies, your spin wave broadens when it becomes paramagnetic. And so here I plotted the spin-spin correlation lines, you know, as a function of increasing energy for the spin excitations. So at low energies, I can see, you know, when it goes to the paramagnetic state, my spin wave, you know, broadens, so means my correlation lines become shorter. So it means the system knows it's in the paramagnetic state. But you see, to answer your question, Andre, for spin excitations above 100 millivolt, nothing happens between the orthorhombic state and the tetragonal state. As you can see from this raw data, things just fall on top of each other. So this clearly indicates, even in the tetragonal phase, there's very strong electronic anisotropy. Unfortunately, you know, we're not smart enough. When we did this experiment, we did not expect, you know, this large electronic anisotropy. So we only did a 10% above TN. So once we've analyzed data, we realize, you know, how stupid we are. So we now, you know, going to try to do much higher temperature measurement to see whether this electronic anisotropy changes or not at even higher temperatures. Oh, everything I talk about is fluctuating. Yeah, so we're talking about spin excitation, which is dynamic. Sorry? Well, but if you go above TN, there's no static patches. When you go to Bragg peak, there's no Bragg peak intensity. Yeah. Right. So now let me, I'm really running, I only talk about one third of what I wanted to talk about. But let me talk about the story in the case of 1-1. So in the case of 1-1, so we've also done similar things. But remember, 1-1 occurs at a wave vector that's 45 degree rotated, you know, from the, and also it's a bilayer, it's a bicollinear spin structure. So we map out the whole spin wave, dispersion curves. And it's also, you know, it's quite broad at the zone boundary energy. Let me sort of show you with one slide sort of how the spin wave excitations evolves. So initially, it stems at the anti-ferromagnetic Bragg points, as you would expect from spin waves. And then it turns around and then come back into the ferromagnetic point. So we were able to fit the whole entire dispersion curve with exchange coupling, you know, both nearest neighbor actually is a ferromagnetic, and the next nearest neighbor is anti-ferromagnetic. And this is quite different from that of the iron arsenic class material. Remember, in iron arsenic class materials, the nearest neighbor is anti-ferromagnetic, and then the second direction B is ferromagnetic. And here we find both directions are ferromagnetic, and the second nearest neighbor is anti-ferromagnetic and directionally independent. So this would suggest to us that because the neutron spin resonance in both class material actually occurs at the same wave vector when you dope it. So we would think that what's determining the neutron spin resonance, you know, must be the second nearest neighbor exchange coupling rather than the nearest neighbor exchange coupling. And that's sort of a current, you know, argument in this class of material. Yes?
What is the neutron resonance?
Yeah. No, you don't have TC at any center, but when you dope it by replacing, well, not really doping, but when you replace a telluride with a selenite, it's not a doping effect because the.
Is it true that I heard rumors that if you use it, then Bragg peak showing difference more there in the superconducting state than in the
time? There's no Bragg order. So your spin excitations, that occurs at the same wave vector. As it would in the case of iron arsenic,
okay.
Identical wave vector. Yeah. So it's consistent with this electron hole pocket excitation idea from gamma to M point.
But this means the spin excitation
evolves. Yes, it changes from this wave vector to that wave vector. Yes. So now let me since we talk about the electron hole pocket excitation, let me talk about some of the work that done by initially by Amazing and then certainly by Thomas Myers and Doc Scalapino. So based on the band structure calculation, it has been argued that you have this so-called neutron spin resonance, which is supposed to be a signature, also by you, right? It's a signature of electron hole pocket excitation. So it has to have a sign change, that to give rise to this so-called neutron spin resonance. And the energy of this resonance is supposed to be slightly smaller than the supernatant gap, added together between the electron and hole pockets. And I just recently discovered a sort of very nice paper by Jörg Schmalin, so which nicely explained the line shape of the spin excitation in the case of electron dope, iron pernickite superconductors. So he's arguing that if you have these electron hole pocket, and this is sort of a five band type of model, so he's arguing that if you consider the moving electron hole pocket excitation, if you move this electron into the hole pocket, assuming a strong electron doping. So he argues that the way you would expect to see nesting is more along the vertical direction. So that's why you see elongated spin excitation of the resonance, along the vertical direction, identical to what you see in the parent compound. Remember, in the parent compound, your excitations are elongated, it's sort of an ellipse along the vertical direction, perpendicular to the anti-ferromagnetic wave ordering vector. So it's called transverse direction, and that's more elongated. And more recently, it has been predicted through a LDA calculation by Keimer's group that if you dope holes onto the system, you get a different story. When you dope holes on the system, effectively, you enlarge this circle but shrink the electron circle. So then they argue that you would expect to see elongations along the horizontal direction, meaning that your spin excitation, once you dope holes into the parent compound is vertical. Once you dope holes into it, you have excitations elongated along the horizontal direction. So I'm really running out of time. So let me sort of summarize our recent result on this aspect. So if you look at the electronic phase diagram of the parent compound, you have a coexisting region between anti-ferromagnetic and superconductivity, and then you have a superconductor without static anti-ferromagnets. So the first story is that one finds the neutron spin resonance, which arises because of suppression of low energy spin excitations. That's sort of the old story. And this resonance we found to be slightly dispersive, meaning that its energy at L equal to zero is slightly different from at L equal to one, which is somewhat different. And this could indicating your superconducting gap may be different along different L directions. So that's the first thing that we did last year, 2 years ago. So then let me show you the data by first actually was shown by Stephen Hayden's group using, I guess, the Ian Fisher sample. But they didn't emphasize that, because at that time it was not realized how interesting this was. So this was the raw data by Stephen Hayden's group showing the resonance. It looks like it's clearly, ellipsed along the vertical direction, and this is the normal state. And more recently, and this was done better by Keimer's group, where they clearly shows this elongation and transverse direction, so explained in terms of this elongation along the nesting along the transverse direction by Jörg Schmalin's group. So now let me show you some very new data that we've done in terms of addressing what happens in the coexisting region. So if we pick a sample somewhere around here, we ask this very simple question, what is the relationship between static anti-ferromagnetism and superconductivity? Whether it's truly coexisting microscopically or coexisting mesoscopically. Unfortunately, neutron scattering is not the best way to study it, simply because of the fact that neutron is a global probe, right? You look at everything that's in the sample. So it's very hard for neutron to tell, whether the coexistence is truly static, it is truly microscopic or mesoscopic. So one way of checking that is to apply a magnetic field. You see, we know what a magnetic field does. We know a magnetic field for sure will suppress superconductivity. So if static order is competing with superconductivity, we want to ask the question whether suppressing superconductivity can enhance static anti-ferromagnet order. And we've done this experiment now. So if you look at the nil temperature for one of those samples, at zero field, you can see you have a nil temperature of 40 Kelvin, and then when it goes to CTC, the static order is somewhat suppressed. But if you turn the magnetic field on for the same sample and the same geometry, Now you can see the static order is slightly enhanced. So this clearly suggests when you suppress superconductivity, you enhance anti-ferromagnetic order. And we also done a very careful measurement, you know, try to study whether such a static order is truly long range or not. And we find that by using lambda over 2 as a resolution, instrument resolution, we find people initially thought it was a really truly long range order. It's actually not truly the same as the lattice long range order. Your lattice long range order is measured by the red circle, and your magnetic long range order is actually measured by the black circle. And you can see it's slightly, you know, broader. So this data seemed to be suggesting, and also, you know, there's recent MuSR data by Tomo Yumura and Graham Luke's group, you know, suggesting that your local field that's seen by MuSR is not changing below TC. You see, neutron scattering experiment have seen clearly a reduction in the Bragg peak intensity when superconductivity happens. But MuSR, from you know, local field they see, they don't really see the local field change. So from this perspective, it seems to be, you know, suggesting, you know, this coexistence might be, you know, misoscopic. So when you, you know, suppress superconductivity, you actually enhances the anti-ferromagnetism. And the data clearly at least suggest there's a direct competition between static anti-ferromagnetism and superconductivity. And this is what the data shows, that when it be below TC, you see the field-induced effect. But when you go above TC, you know, there's still magnetic order. The 11 tesla field has no effect. Yeah. Oh, this is the anadoped. This is the anadoped. Yeah, in this regime. Yeah. So the enhanced static order is at the expense of the neutron spin resonance. So you have the suppression of the excitation that shovels intensity into the elastic scattering. So this is the story we have in the case of electron doped material. Now let me talk about some new results we have in the case of a Hall doped material. So I only got like 10 minutes left. Yeah. Sorry? It's the same as nickel. We haven't, but since so many other people does the, it's to the first order identical. Well, in the case of cobalt doping, that their neutron scattering and also X-ray scattering experiments suggesting that the line width of the Bragg peaks that's seen is truly long-ranged. So right now, I think the state is in the flux, so we don't completely understand it yet. Yeah, so that, I think that's a fair statement. Yeah. Okay. So now let me sort of talk about the Hall doping. So this is sort of the phase diagram in terms of Hall doping. So we first decided to do a sample that has no static long range order, because that's the safest thing to do. Because when you have static long range order, you know, the question is whether it's coexisting misoscopically, you know, or microscopically with superconductivity. So we just decided to do a sample with no static order. So we see no elastic scattering. And we've done, you know, various things we can on the sample and shown that it's quite homogeneous. So we also you know, confirmed the neutron spin resonance, and this was actually first seen in the powder by Ray Osborne's group and Andy Christensen at Oak Ridge. So this resonance here is about 15 milli electron volt, because TC in the Hall doping is about 40 Kelvin instead of 20 Kelvin in the case of electron doped material. And interestingly, this resonance, the line shape has no change above and below TC. So we see very little dispersion of the resonance, and then it really turns on at TC, you know, completely identical to that of the electron doped material. So this is not really surprising. But what is really surprising is we have discovered that the excitations, if you look at the resonance around the, you know, 10 to 18 milli electron volt, remember in the case of electron doped materials, it's an oval shape, you know, vertical to the anti-ferromagnetic wave vector. And now we do a time of flight measurement. This is done at Oak Ridge on arc spectrometer. And you just get a whole pattern. And we actually get four patterns, because we have all four symmetries. You can see this thing rotate four times. So you see, it's really horizontal now, completely consistent with LDA calculation. And then when you go from above to below TC, the shape does not stay, does not change. But what's surprising is that if you go at energy below the resonance, where we expect to see a spin gap, and this is exactly, you know, triple axis measurement will tell you, you'd expect to see a spin gap around the, you know, low energies. what you discover is that the spin excitations completely changes the line shape and changes from oval shape to a circular shape from the normal to the superconducting state. And the question is, you know, whether this change is associated with superconductivity, whether the line shape change exactly occurs at TC. And let me show you, you know, it really does occur at TC. And first, let me show you, you know, the line shape change is real. And let me, I show the data in terms of cutting along the H direction for the resonance, along the K direction for the resonance, both above and below TC. I see no changes in the line shape. You know, for the black will be below TC, the red will be above TC. Both H and K direction is identical. But when I do the same cut for energies below the resonance, I see that, you know, the normal state horizontally, H direction, have a very broad peak, and that drastically narrows up along the K direction. I see hardly any changes. So essentially, what superconductivity does is that dramatically increase the coherence lines, you know, for excitations below the neutron resonance. Remember, if you're supposed to have a very simple S plus, S minus states, you know, in ideal isotropic S wave state, you should not expect much of excitation at all below the neutron spin resonance, because neutron spin resonance determines the energy scale. Everything should be gapped out below that. What we instead observe is a drastic line width change, but there's still a lot of excitations below that energy. And now let me show you the much higher, yeah. So it's gapped, right? Yeah. So I'm trying to explain why that is the case. So this is gapped. This is because I'm at L of equals to 2. So now I'm changing. See, when I do time of flight measurement, I have integrating various L. So now if I'm changing, doing a triple axis measurement, I can do much precise measurement. I can measure both at L equal to 2, which is equivalent to L equal to 0. And also I can measure L equal to 1, which is also anti-ferromagnetic along the C axis. I get two different answers. So for L equal to 0, I see very clean gap, just like I did for L equals to 2 cases. Yeah, so now if I go to L equal to 1, I see the excitations are gapless. All the way gapless, all the way to 0.75 millielectron volt. No, there's also resonance, but resonance occurs somewhere here, about 15 millielectron volt. The resonance occurs at both L's, as I've shown. At L equal to 2, which is equivalent to 0, and L equal to 3, which is equivalent to 1. It's just at L equal to 0, you have a clean spin gap below the resonance. At L equal to 1, you do not. So now let me show you the data. Yeah, in the time of flight measurement, you see, this is like one shot. You come in with 75 millielectron volt, and you do an integration through a range of L's. So that's why you see this blob that's still there. But in the triple axis, which is sort of like a shotgun, and you can tune whatever L you want to tune. But the problem with shotgun approach is that you don't get the vertical information. You only have the information in one plane. So in the information that we get is the horizontal scattering plane. So we can only measure scattering along this direction. We do not measure scattering along this direction. In fact, we did this experiment, you know, about a year ago. We always only along the HHL zone. We didn't realize it was this oval shape until we put on the time of flight spectrometer and look at the whole spectrum. And we realized it was different along the vertical direction than the electron dope case. So you can see the gap are really L dependent. And to prove to you that's the case, let me show you the constant energy scans. You know, at 5 millivolt, at L equal to 0, normal state, I see red. When it becomes superconducting, it becomes black. At the same energy, 5 millielectron volt, now I do at L equal to 1. I see I'm scanning along the anti-ferromagnetic direction. So in the normal state, I see a broad peak. When it becomes superconducting, this broad peak sharply narrows down. And when I go down to 1 millivolt, at L equal to 1, I still see a peak. But at L equals to 1, equals to 0.75 millivolt, I don't see anything. So the gap at L equal to 1 becomes 0.75 millielectron volt. as compared the gap at L equal to 0 equal to 5 milli electron volt. There's a drastic difference in spin gaps between L equal to 1 and L equal to 0. Now let me show you what that's associated with superconductivity. To prove that, I can do at L equal to 0, which I expect to see a clean gap, right? So at 3 millivolt, I can look at it, you know, I can clearly see a kink, and then I want to measure background. The scattering merges into background, indicating it's completely gapped out at 3 milli electron volt. Now I do identical experiment, except I'm now moving to L equal to 1. I can see also a clean gap. I can also clean kink at TC. But now, at low temperatures, I see it does not gap out. And this is the background scan. So I clearly have density of states at L equal to 1. And let me show you the whole picture of a 5 milli electron volt, you know, taken on mass spectrometer and NIST. You can clearly see it peaks at 1 and minus 1 and sort of gaps out around, you know, a 0, L equal to 0 region. You can see this clear C-axis modulation. And finally, now let me show you, you know, whether this the width of the excitations are indeed associated with superconductivity. So far, I only showed you the intensity of it, knows TC. I wanted to measure whether the width of this low energy excitation also knows superconductivity, and also wanted to measure whether that knows the spin gap or not. Because the spin gap is something, you know, that we measure. So I can measure the on mass spectrometer, I can measure these excitations, you know, at many, many different temperatures. So I choose two energy. I first choose an energy below the spin gap, which is about 4 milli electron volt. I can see the width of this excitation initially stays the same, and then around TC, it shows clearly a kink. I would assume you would agree with me. There's something happens right around TC. And for excitations around 6 milli electron volt, I see identical things. So therefore, this changing from oval shape to circular shape of the low energy excitations really happens at TC. And now let me show you the raw data to supporting my argument. You can see these are the raw data. You know, I mean, this data are only possible because the development of a new spectrometer on Mars, which has 40 times the flux than the old spectrometer. Because each of this point, you know, is very, very expensive if you take, you know, simply the simple, you know, a triple axis measurement. But on Mars, you really measure much, much faster. You can really see the line width change. You know, you can see that really occurs, you know, right around TC. And for 6 millivolt, I also have the raw data, but I didn't have time to show. So let me sort of put a concluding slide. So I've essentially shown several things, right? The first thing I showed is that the now, you know, through intensive effort, you know, we essentially understand the exchange coupling in the parent compound of the pentactide is strongly anisotropic between A and B direction. And for the barium, and also for the strontium compound, you know, this electronic anisotropy actually persists in the tetragonal state. So that's the first statement. And the second statement is that, you know, between the system between the iron arsenic and iron telluride, you know, it's the next nearest neighbor exchange coupling that's similar between these two classes of material. And third thing I showed is that, you know, the anti-Farman order in the coexisting region is directly competing with superconductivity. And then, you know, we show the resonance is three-dimensional and spin excitations in whole and electron doped material have some similarities, but also, you know, differences. And we argue that the fact that you see a lot of excitations, you know, in the case of a whole doped material suggests there must be some local moments playing a role in those materials, because otherwise it's very hard to understand. If you believe the, you know, opposite result suggests, you know, it's completely gapped out. So when you completely gap out, you know, in a superconducting state, you know, whatever left, you know, has to be coming from some electrons that's not contributing, you know, to conductivity, right, superconductivity. So that's suggesting, you know, probably, you know, local moments. Yeah. Okay, so I'll stop here. Yes. Yes.
And so from that point of view, what you see above Kimeo seems to be very nicely, or could possibly be nicely connected with the thing after.
Yes, yes. By the S group. Yeah, yeah.
The X group, right? And where above Kimeo, they also see that the optical are different.
Yeah. One thing, though, I would caution is that in ZX case, probably Ian knows more. I mean, is that they see a drastic population change across T, right? Whereas we see very little change in the high energy excitation. So I would expect in our case that when we do high energy, high temperature spin excitation measurement near the zone boundary, we will probably to see this thing persist to much higher temperatures than probably they would. But I don't know. Yeah. No.
So there are well-defined hardships and there are well-defined rates, both L equals 0 and L equals 1, and there's a tail of spectral waves for L equals 1 and it steps down to the
rate. And a circular shape, yes.
Yeah, sure.
Below TC.
Can we look at the data for the rate for L equals 1 and L equals 0?
Oh. Actually, we've done both. I mean, I haven't showed the raw data, but this is at L equal to, I can't remember. This is at L equal to 0, but L equal to 1 will be the same along the H direction cut.
What's
That's very hard to understand. From simple Fermi surface nesting point of view, it's very hard to get the line shape of the excitation to change, right? So the way we tentatively interpret the result is that assuming this oval shape is really coming from itinerary electrons. So when the system becomes superconducting, you completely gap out the itinerary electrons, you know, within the conducting electrons. You gap that out. So below the resonance, whatever left is those electrons that does not contribute to superconductivity will suggest that you must be some local moments as well in the system. I mean, that's my. Yeah, but yeah, it is low energy electrons, but that's why you see. That's why I mean that's my argument. That's why you only see the line shape change, you know, for energies below the neutron spin resonance. I shouldn't say localized. I should say localized, local, some sort of some electrons that there has to be something that contributing to those. Yeah, there has to be something that's not contributing to superconducting that gives rise to these excitations, right? And that's more precise, yeah. Yeah. We have not done that. That's planned. That's I mean, it's just too many samples, too many things to do, right? So limited beam time, limited manpower. Yeah, we have not done that. I don't think anyone else has done that either.
In the product talk, you were talking about the coexistence of the numeric orders within the group, and you showed this plot where you applied the numeric neon. So, what is your quantitative measure? You said that it's a clear change, a clear drop. You see, like, when I see this data for the first time, I would have said it's like the market.
Yeah, but remember.
In comparison to other measurements, what gave you the quantitative confidence that this is the medicine of
the drastic change? Yeah, so I mean, but remember, we can only apply, you know, up to 15 tesla. 15 tesla in terms of upper critical field on these materials are very small. These materials have very high, I mean, 50, 60 tesla upper critical field. So the reason I'm confident that this effect is real is because I can do this measurement both above and below TC. You see, I can do a transfer scan. I can do a rocking curve scan, both on the background and on the signal, right? So this is the field difference data between field on and field off. I can clearly see a peak at low temperature. But when I do the same scan, I would have a huge peak, right, on top of like 5% change. When I do a same scan in the new state, but above TC, I don't see anything. So this essentially suggests to me that whatever changes I see has to be due to suppression of superconductivity. And because the new temperature of the system is not modified by amplification of an 11 tesla field. And also, people have done in terms of the parent compound, you know, in the potassium dope case, the one phase separated, you know, when you turn on a magnetic field, you should see the anti-FR magnet suppress under the field, not increasing. And we see it increasing.
I don't
Yeah, 2 Kelvin. The change of TC is about 2 Kelvin. So I didn't have time to show the data. And this is expanded data, right? It changes from 17K to 15K. And this data is so new. We haven't written the paper yet, but we will have a paper soon.